Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
Microsoft, you know, I remember it being around because I grew up in Atlanta, and I remember there being a big Microsoft office with a big Microsoft sign on it, but nobody really back then knew exactly what they did.
Welcome to Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast. Your place for resources and in-depth conversations with other game development professionals. I'm your host, John J.P. Podlasic. I've worked at 10 different game companies, starting back in 1989 with the TurboGrafx-16. Over the decades, I've developed games like Mortal Kombat, Avengers Initiative, Beavis and Butthead, and numerous others. I now work for a startup called Level X. But this podcast isn't about me, it's about you and the game development community. So if you have questions or ideas, give a call, 224-484-7733, or go to the gamedevadvice.com website. I have a great episode for you today, so let's kick things off with the new Game Dev Advice. Today's guest is Dwayne Mason, co-founder and co-owner of NXA Studios China and NXA Studios Argentina. NXA Studios is one of the leading art production service companies in the game development industry. Art development and art production support for PlayStation, Xbox, and PC game development is their main line of service. NXA Studios has contributed to major game franchises such as Mortal Kombat, Assassin's Creed, Call of Duty, Street Fighter, Resident Evil, Monster Hunter, and many more. Prior to starting NXA Studios, Dwayne had been a mocap specialist very early in his career. In fact, he was the very first full-time mocap tech in the world. Eventually, that role led to a long stint at Sony PlayStation in the software games division, building and running the first-party art services group there. After Sony, he was named studio art director for Midway Amusement Games headquarters in Chicago in 2007. Midway survived just shy of 2 years from that point, but that eventually led to him starting his own company, NXA Studios. NXA is now in its 8th year of service and still growing steadily. Let's talk to Dwayne. Hey, Dwayne, how's it going?
Great, John. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate the invite.
Cool. Glad to have you on. All right, we'll kick things off. Kind of tell me about your current role in the company.
Well, currently I use the title of Vice President, Business and Marketing for NXA Studios. And my role in business and marketing covers, you know, of course, marketing, which everyone kind of gets what that involves. And then the business side is sort of intertwined with the type of marketing things that we will typically do, which is, you know, attending trade shows and conferences, and the occasionally I do some light client outreach kind of stuff, you know, kickoff meetings for new projects and support calls when an issue comes up here or there. And then the occasional, you know, on-site client visit. Those are usually fun. So,
yeah. No, that's cool. Well, that's interesting, the role in having the company and things like that. Can you kind of back things up and kind of tell us how you got started in the video game industry?
Well, let's see. I got really back it up. I got all the way back to high school. I kind of got started by not getting started in a sense, because, you know, when you get to be in 11th or 12th grade in high school, you got to really start thinking seriously about what it is you want to be and do, so that you can sort of, you know, tune in on that and focus in college, aim your degree at what it is you think you want to be later in life. And so for me, by the time I got to that point, I had a little bit of a conundrum, because I had from basically a pretty artistic family. My dad's really good at art. My brother and myself, we were all kind of naturally good at it. And so I knew I wanted to do something along the lines of, you know, of art production, art and creativity. But at the same time, I was a kid that I had a subscription to Entrepreneur magazine when I was 13, and I read How to Win Friends and Influence People. And I was really trying to do a lot to learn about, you know, how to be successful in business, even from a young age. So I kind of had that drive, kind of in the, you know, push me from behind. And so the issue that I had was that, you know, being an artist, being a successful artist is about like, it's kind of like being a musician in a way. There's a lot of, you know, really great, talented musicians out there, but very few, you know, make it to the point of being a rock star. And so I kind of, you know, I kind of felt like I wanted to do both, but I didn't know how to accomplish that. So the solution that I came up with was I decided to go to college and pursue a degree in graphic design with an eye towards going into advertising. Because
exactly what I did.
Oh, yeah.
In some ways.
I didn't know that.
I have a BFA in graphic design. And then, I spent a short period as a graphic artist, or excuse me, a computer graphic artist, and then was trying to retool my portfolio for ad agencies. So, yeah.
When I went to school, the thing that happened that really kind of broke for me in the right way was that as I was pursuing my, you know, graphic design degree, one of the things that came along was the personal computer revolution. And it may be kind of hard for, you know, some of the younger people that may be listening to us today to really kind of grasp this. But back in those days, you know, that was the days of pagers. There were no cell phones. I mean, there were mobile phones had just were coming out. And those things were like, you know, the size of a brick and probably weighed about the same as a brick. And even then you had to be a big time CEO to carry one of those around. And Microsoft, you know, I remember it being around because I grew up in Atlanta, and I remember there being a big Microsoft office with a big Microsoft sign on it, but nobody really back then knew exactly what they did, you know, unless you happened to be in the end of the industry. It was just an unknown thing before the personal computer revolution sort of happened. So, because this is, you know, 89, 90, I believe, is about the time frame there.
Okay.
So the thing that really broke for me was while I was in school, the Georgia State University had a class that they offered that was PC Paint. And basically it was a Microsoft Paint program, I think the first or second version probably. And I believe, if I remember, there was a Corel Draw element to it.
Oh, yeah.
So I got into that class and I just said, okay, I think this is for me. This is where it's going. Not that you could do so much with it, but it was just cool, you know, to use a new medium like that to be able to create artwork. And you could kind of see that it, you know, if it got better, it was going to be big, you know? So I really got excited and sort of put a focus on that. The next thing that really broke my way and kind of set me off on my career path was just one of those, you know, kind of lucky kismet type of situations, because I was putting myself through school and I was working for a valet company in downtown Atlanta, valet parking cars at night, you know, and I would work at a nice restaurant one night or a hotel another night. And it was pretty cool because sometimes I'd work at the nicer hotels and there would be rock stars staying there. You know, like I met Robin Zander of Cheap Trick one time, you know, Valley Park. Yeah. And so I was busy doing that. And a fellow pulled up one night in a big old, you know, sedan rental car. And, you know, typically I would help guests, you know, pull their luggage out of the back of the trunk or whatever and you know, give it to the bellhop type of guy. And so I was helping this gentleman unload the back of his trunk, and he had a lot of big cardboard boxes with videotape, you know, the videotape boxes in them. And you remember those big plastic, you know, cases the videotapes came in. And on the front of that videotape box was a very obviously 3D computer generated golfer swinging a golf club with a bunch of lines and stuff coming, you know, trailing the
swing or something.
And so being someone that was in school, in art, interested in doing computer graphics. And again, you know, the old band stories, but this is back when I think Luxo was the first thing Pixar had done and probably the only thing they had done at that point. You know, so it was early 3D computer graphics days, you know. I think Max Headroom had been on MTV and that looked like computer graphics, but that was mostly fake. You know, that was a guy in a mask.
Yeah.
So made to look like a CG render. So I was really interested in that. So I just bugged the hell out of this guy. And, you know, he was a friendly type of guy, lucky for me. And we kind of hit it off and started conversing a bit. And he was in town that week to do a remote setup of a motion capture system on the paddock, the training paddock of the Atlanta Country Club, where they were hosting a PGA Tour event for the week. So what they were doing is they were using motion capture to do sports analysis. And that was the business plan of the company that this gentleman owned. And so they were in the early stages. They were still, you know, developing the software. And this is all stuff that was running on Silicon Graphics machines on, you know, under Unix. And the mocap system, the host machines were the Sun Microsystems, you know, which were also kind of a variant of Unix. And so I didn't know anything about any of that stuff. You know, I mean, I'd been doing CorelDRAW, you know, on a, on a PC. But I really, really wanted to get into it. And so just, you know, bugging the guy, talking to him every time I saw him come and go over the next few days, I got him to, you know, sit down with me and kind of let me, you know, kind of explain to me what they were doing, how they were doing it. And it was really, really cool to see, because to me, immediately I went to animation, you know, because they're actually capturing motion and, you know, generating a computer animated character with that motion on it. Mm-hmm. And the character was very rudimentary, of course. It was just, you know, basically, you know, 12 or 14 parts, 2 feet, two lower legs, two upper legs, you know, et cetera. But I found it really, really interesting. And so long story short, they ended up hiring me as a gopher for the whole week of the golf tournament there. And they were there to capture the PGA Tour pros. So they were capturing, you know, Fred Couples and Arnold Palmer and Peter Jacobs.
Oh, wow.
You know, all the guys of that era that were the big stars at the time. So I went out there and it was kind of cool because it was, they had a, one of those big giant party tents set up. And they had really nice flowers and plants and water fountains and a big Barco screen, which was the biggest, you know, that was the biggest big screen you could get at the time in any kind of resolution. So it was really cool to do that. And so they had a deal with a lead software engineer, a guy named Frank Bitz, and he went on to do a lot of cool things. The most recognizable for people in general would probably be, he's the guy that wrote the water simulation stuff for the Stargate. Remember the old Stargate movies?
Oh, yeah.
They would jump through water thing. He wrote that algorithm for that. And so he was a visual effects and CG programmer type of guy. Mm-hmm. And so in addition to Frank, who lived in Atlanta at the time, they were using all the graduate students at Georgia Tech's multimedia lab, which was probably, you know, second or third or fourth in the nation after MIT. Mm-hmm. And so they had a lot of high-end equipment and a lot of, you know, really, you know, pretty stellar programmers and things like that going. And those guys were writing the BioVision software. And the purpose of the software was to take the 3D motion data plot and then, you know, build the hierarchy chain and animate the 3D graphics. And so that was really the start of motion capture. That was it right there. And that was my very first foray into that. And then, so that tournament came and went and I did all the work and I worked hard and I bugged the hell out of the guys that were there, you know, running the system and doing the programming, trying to learn as much as I could from them while I was there for a week. Then they called me up again and they said, hey, because they were based in California in Santa Rosa. And they called me up about, I think, a month or two later, and they said, hey, we're coming down, and we're going to go do another tournament in, I think it was at Torrey Pines.
Oh, that's a famous one. Yeah,
North Carolina. And so they had machines that they were getting in a deal with Silicon Graphics, which was in a suburb of Atlanta. And then they had the motion capture system. Part of the deal with Georgia Tech was they lent them their motion capture system that BioVision owned for all the time, you know, let them use that. And the machines that they had while these guys were working on the, you know, the software programming for them. And, you know, there were other parts to it, but that was a big part of it. So they tasked me to go to Georgia Tech and pack up and load up all the mocap, all the, you know, the systems that go with that. And then they had me go out to Marietta in Atlanta to pick up the big Silicon Graphics 310 machine, which was like a 300-pound dual tower. You know, it had casters on it. You had to roll it.
Yeah.
That thing was huge. So I had to go out there and pick that up and then and drive all that up to Pinehurst and set up for the next golf tournament and spend the week there doing that. So I spent another week with all the programmers and all the mocap equipment and all the hardware and software. And it had come along quite a ways since, you know, in the couple of few months since the last tournament. And so at that point, I knew the guys a little bit more and they started really teaching me a bit about how to set up the mocap system and how to operate, you know, the Sun platforms and how to, you know, edit some data and all that kind of stuff. So from that point, I was, you know, the one guy that kind of was learning how to do all that stuff. And those guys didn't want to do it. They were busy, you know, trying to write the software.
Yeah.
So, you know, the story goes on and on. But long story short is eventually this fellow flew out from California and said he wanted to take me to lunch. And he offered me a job. And he said, move to California. And I said, you know, because I'm like 20 years old at this point. So I thought about it. And I decided I was going to take a hiatus from school and give this a shot and see how it might work out. And so that's what I did. I rented a U-Haul and I packed up all my shit and I moved to California.
Now, credit to you, right? Because you had the ambition, you nagged them, you did a good job when you were asked to, and you know, you proved your value. And when they had a need, they're like, let's call that guy that that young kid that was hustling.
Yeah, and I knew I saw something special too. When I saw that, I knew it wasn't just an everyday thing. I said, oh, this is really something, you know. I want to be part of this thing, whatever that leads to. Because right. I knew it would lead to something. I just didn't know what. The funny thing is, it could have really, because I was the first full-time motion capture employee. The other guys, you know, the Georgia Tech guys were students on a contract. Frank Vince was on a contract writing the software. So they hired me when I moved to California, and I was their first employee. And so I literally was the first full-time mocap person in the, probably in the world, I guess. I mean, not count. Yeah. I mean, because those systems were made for like, you know, gait analysis and medical study and things like that, you know. How does a baboon, you know, motivate, that sort of stuff?
Yeah, right? Yeah. Psychology stuff and things. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Motion study kind of things like physiology. But they were taking it and using it for entertainment purposes. And their goal was to do, like I say, sports analysis. And for the first two or three years at BioVision, that's what we did. We did sports analysis. We did tons of PGA golf tour stuff. And we actually got our stuff on, you know, on the broadcast on ABC Sports on Sunday, the PGA, you know, whichever tournament happened to be. We would go there and capture pros, and then they would say, oh, we're going to look at BioVision, you know, and they would break it down and analyze the golf swing. And then we went to Colorado Springs and did all the Olympic sports that we could do. We couldn't do swimming, but almost everything else we did. And then we ended up doing, you know, through Frank Vitz, who was kind of in Hollywood at that point. He got a lot of like CG animated commercials and movie stuff going for us because he was kind of becoming a big name in, you know, visual effects and such.
Right, so right.
We did a lot of really interesting things over those years kind of pertaining to motion capture.
Yeah, yeah. And again, very much in the early days, not like now where you can, you just, if you have the money, you just buy the Vicon system.
Oh, no, yeah.
And all
it was,
those kind
it
of
wasn't
things.
Plug and play. We were the only game in town because we were the only people that had that, you know, that could bridge that gap between the actual motion data, plotting all the points to creating, you know, a fully animated hierarchical skeleton from that. You know, and then applying 3D graphics to follow that skeleton. That was the trick of it. I mean, I have a letter somewhere in my storage from James Cameron wanting to, he met with us for in the pre-production of Terminator 2 because they wanted to talk to us doing the T-10,000 animation. I got to go to Industrial Light and Magic back when it was in, where was it, San? It was hidden.
Yeah.
I mean, they literally had full storefronts like dentists, accountant on all of the warehouses.
Shoe repair.
Yeah, exactly. It was literally like that. And you go in there and you walk in and there's the original R2-D2 model and, you know, hanging on the wall is a Star Destroyer and the matte painting from Peter Pan, you know, it's just crazy.
Yeah.
We went in there and we spent probably 5 or 6 hours there. And man, I could have spent 5 or 6 days. It was a dream for me. You know,
slack job walking around there. Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. But like most things those days, that we were a small company, you know, pioneering stuff. We didn't have a lot of money, you know. All these big names wanted us to basically work for them for free just for the benefit of having worked for them. And you can make that work in some cases, but I think the two brothers that actually owned BioVision were not, I don't think they were quite that savvy to figure out how to make those things work out, you know. And if they had, I would probably be, you know, independently wealthy just from having been the first person there at that company. You know what I mean?
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But unfortunately, as things go, that kind of, you know, that ran its course. But what did happen was we set up shop in San Francisco. At the beginning, we were based up in Santa Rosa, up in the wine country. Beautiful place. Mm-hmm. So I lived up there for a couple of years. Then we eventually located the company down in the heart of San Francisco and got a space there. Well, we spent a little time on San Hope Road in Palo Alto, which was it's the center of venture capital. And that was smart on their part because they got Charles Schwab and a bunch of other, you know, kind of heavy hitters. Frank Harrington was the head of Transamerica at the time. And they got, you know, a bunch of those types really excited about, you know, the technology. And they could have gotten any of them to really invest in it and build something great out of it. But for whatever reason, and, you know, I wasn't privy to their business dealings at the time, but they never made it happen. Yeah. And I know they had the interest because I was the one that was, you know, analyzing all these guys' golf swings when they came in, you know, 3 times a month. But that never happened. But what did happen was we got set up and we started doing stuff for video games. And this was the Sega Saturn days and the PlayStation 1 and the, you know, the early days, you know, along those lines. So the mocap that we were doing was being used to animate in, you know, like in Wavefront Alias, you know, and then they were rendering sprites out that were, and the games were pushing 2D sprites, but they were animated in 3D, you know, with motion capture. Mm-hmm. And mainly we were doing a lot of sports games. You know, we were doing some shooters and some fighting games, but we were, I guess we were doing a pretty good variety of games back then, but that sort of evolved. And we did that for 2 or 3 years. And then at one point we had developed a relationship with several clients and Sony was one of them. Okay. And so at one of the Sony shoots, the guys, kind of the senior guys came over, you know, cause I was the guy that ran all the projects at BioVision, managed everything. And they kind of took me to the side, or maybe it was at a lunch one day or something. And they said, hey, how about you come work for a real company? You know? We'll buy you whatever you want. We'll buy you whatever you need. So it took me about a year to, because I had to think about that one, because I was a big fish in a very small pond. You know, I was the lead guy.
Yeah.
And you know, you right. go to Sony and or an EA or something like that, and it's a big, you know, it's a big organization. So right. eventually they got me down to San Diego for an interview. And then once I saw San Diego, I said, okay, I'll be there. Here I come. give me a Here spot, please. Yeah. I'm sold. So I went to Sony in 1996 and they hired me to start mocap there, start a mocap studio. And so they actually had a mocap system, but when I got there to see it, it was the same room that the testing department was in. And the testers had literally set up, used the tripod of the mocap cameras to set up tents to sleep under while they were testing. And it was like hardened milkshake on the floor. And it was like a college dorm. It was just a wreck. So I got down there and started all that. But I started off with mocap there. And then eventually I was at Sony almost 12 years. And by the time I wow. finished, I had built what we called the Central Art, you know, Services Group. And, we did a lot of things, but mocap was one of them. And that became a huge, you know, they actually ultimately built me this world-class facility there. And then we pioneered a lot of 3D scan stuff because it was the same thing as when we started mocap. There wasn't any 3D scan system, but we took some existing, you know, stuff from industrial manufacturing, things like that. And, we kind of hobbled it all together with the Hasselblad 35, you know, megapixel camera, which at that time was just mind blowing. Resolution. And then we hired an engineer to write the, you know, photogrammetry stuff to be able to use the textures with the 3D geometry that we generated from the 3D scanner. It was like a German auto manufacturing, you know, scanning system, like $400,000 or some ridiculous thing at the time.
Wow.
So, yeah. But Tony, that was, you know, those were the PlayStation 2 and early, you know, heading into PlayStation 3 years, and things were good at Sony, say the least at that time. But so we did 3D scan and motion capture, and then we ended up having a cinematics group in there, and I ran the audio department for a short time there. And then we had a tools and technology group that was tasked with, you know, providing support for art production services. So we had tools guys that would write us, you know, scripts and Python scripts, you know, and various pipeline tools and things like that, which was a huge boon. So, yeah, so we ended up, having sort of a full service internal art production group that basically only served Sony first party games. So I had a limited client base. But, you know, Sony was making a lot of games, a lot of variety of games, because we were making 10 or 12 sports games at that time. And then, you know, there were all the SOCOMs and the Twisted Metals and God of War and stuff like that. Then we built a cinematics group and we got into, you know, HD level cinematic stuff, which was really exciting and cool and interesting. So that whole thing just evolved over the, you know, the first 7 or 8 years that I was there. And then eventually it got to the point where I was sitting at the top of this rather large department that had, you know, I don't know, 5 or 6 different subgroups within the department. And each of those groups had their own manager. And my management style is to let those guys, you know, really learn and know everything about what they're there to do and then let them do that thing, you know, because they're the expert then.
Yeah, get out of their ways. Yeah.
So what that leads to is me sitting kind of at the top of this pyramid with not much to do and, you know, not getting to do the fun stuff anymore. So, you know, I was dealing with legal and facilities. And then when you had to fire somebody, I had to deal with all that stuff and, you know, budgeting. And, you know, 5 or 6 years of that, I kind of got really stale. And then there was some political stuff that's, you know, that typically happens when you're in a company of that size. You know, you get a, you know, who runs this versus who runs that and who has, all that stuff just kind of started building up on my shoulders and kind of, I was not really super happy. So I ended up leaving Sony in 2007. And then I think it was later in 2007 when I went to Midway. And of course, that's where I met you.
Yeah, that's an impressive background there. And I didn't realize you were at Sony that long too. That's very cool.
Yeah, I think it was 11 and a half years or something.
Yeah. That's a hell of a run at a video game company, right? Or a platform or, you know, however you want to classify it, just knowing the volatility of our industry and all that.
Well, you know what? I'll tell you a little funny secret that not many people know or now maybe they do now, but didn't know then. But my mom actually moved to California because we had, you know, we had started a family and she wanted to be near the kids. And so she and her husband moved to California, and he's a little bit younger than her. She's kind of a little bit of a cradle robber, but he's a great guy. And so when they moved out, he had zero experience in this, but I hired him because we had just started a 3D scan department. And whoever we had there, we had to train from the ground up anyway to do the production work. And so I hired him to do the production, to be one of the production guys in the 3D scan group. And he's been there almost, I think, 18 or 19 years now. He's still there.
He's good hire.
He's still, and every year he goes to spring training and he captures every single new MLB player that there is. And he's a big sports fan too. So mocap 3D scan, a lot of it's sports based stuff. So,
right.
So he's still there. Still.
Happy's a clam, right? He's still there.
Doing well. Yep. Doing well.
That's cool. Well, cool. What do you wish you had known when you started?
Well, when I got that opportunity with BioVision, one of the things that kind of happened to me was I had to dive in with, both feet. And to do that, I really had to get to know those programmers that were building the software and understand the software. And to do that, I had to dig into it somewhat from some time to time and actually try to fix things myself or make a little change. Cause I became the de facto or the default designer of the software because I was the end user. So I had to learn some Unix programming stuff. And, the SGI machines were running on a variant of Unix called Solaris. And so,
very expensive too.
Yeah. That stuff was crazy expensive at the time. But yeah, so if I had known, if I had had a little bit of heads up and known to learn some of that in advance, that probably would have helped me. But looking back on it, I think I kind of just simply learned it when I had to and only learned as much as was necessary for me to do what I needed to do. And then, so that worked out well. But those lines, that's one thing that pops up to me that I wish I'd known. One cool thing was that I had spent some time, establishing a Domino's Pizza franchise just prior to all that, all the other stuff happening. And what I learned doing that has been invaluable to me throughout my career because, we did everything. We leased a former clothing store and ripped everything out of it and turned it into a pizza store, including the drop ceiling and the flooring and the tiles on the walls. And we ordered, and I was young then. I was, I think 18 or 19 when I did that. It just so happened that I worked at Domino's when I was in high school, and I kind of became friends with the manager of the store, who was like a 23, 24-year-old guy. And he ended up with an opportunity to go and start a 5 or 6 store franchise, which at that time, Domino's was a huge success and a huge business, and you could not get a franchise in the U.S. because they were all taken.
Yeah.
But his family had a friend, and his friend had a franchise area. And he had opened, 6 or 8 stores and was making just gobs of money. And he just didn't want the hassle of having any more stores. So he basically gave them a franchise area. So over the course of the, last 6 or 8 months of my senior year in high school, he kind of talked me into going with him. And it's funny because one of the deliveries I would regularly make in my area where we lived, which was a nice suburb of Atlanta, was this community called Riverside. And Riverside was, the nice, big, fancy houses, like, one or two of them had a helipad in it, nice, big stuff. And one of the guys that I would deliver to regularly there was this little old man in basically a mansion. And he would answer the door. And every time he answered the door, he had a Waffle House shirt on because he was a Waffle House franchisee. You know what Waffle House is, right?
Okay, quick question break. What are your thoughts so far? Do you have a topic idea, a question to ask, or a guest suggestion? Let me know at 224-484-7733 or on the gamedevadvice.com website.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've been there. Yeah,
Waffle House is kinda 3 a.m.,
Yeah, it's late and you're drunk.
Exactly.
Welcome to Waffle House.
Yep. Yeah. And then you got your truckers and your, various people.
It's like an IHOP.
Yeah. But that really sunk into my brain because I said, wow, that's a way you can succeed. That's a path to success. Mm-hmm. That little old guy. And I talked to him, I asked him about things and, he gave me a little few life tips and lessons along the way sometimes. But anyway, so when that Domino's franchise opportunity came along, I said, man, maybe that's my Waffle House. So I went and did it. And long story short, Jeff, the way the franchise system worked is you had to have a manager that had like a year or 2 years or something of experience in order to become a franchisee. So Jeff had to take on a partner, even though it was his franchise area that he got. So he took on this partner named Bob, and Bob turned out to be a real jerk. And Bob and I just did not get along. So we accomplished a lot. We opened, I think, 4 or 5 stores about a year. And like I say, that's why I learned so much, because we did everything, like from building to running to marketing to managing to hiring, firing, everything you can do. And I learned
soup to nuts.
I learned a ton about running a business in that short, quick time as a pretty young guy. And that's been really helpful to me.
I had no idea about that. And yeah, Domino's. Yeah, for a while that it was the only big pizza franchise. You know, they had the pizza noid.
Yeah. Avoid the noid.
Avoid the noid. Yeah, that was a big deal. So like, what kind of advice would you give someone in their career now that they're, you know, is working as an artist or an animator, you know, currently in the industry, and they want to take their skills to the next level, or maybe get a promotion or look to work for a new company? You know, what are your thoughts around that?
Well, I think a piece of advice that's pretty much universal. But having said that, it may not apply equally to everyone, because the effect of this advice is I would, you know, you can bet on it, but it does have, you have to then deal with the effects of it. So let me just run it down and see what you think about it.
Okay.
Basically, it's personality based in some ways, and it probably works best for people who are a little bit more aggressive and kind of determined personality types, you know, like me.
Yeah.
It took me some hard lessons kind of over the years, particularly in my time at Sony when I was building various different teams, to actually learn that not everybody's like me. Not everybody has the same goals and the same aspirations and wants to drive as hard as me. And you know, I made a few mistakes along the way with putting people in positions and kind of dragging people up who may not have wanted to come up that chain. You know what I mean? So now I couch this piece of advice with a disclaimer that it might not be for everybody. But it's a pretty simple and incredibly effective way to open doors and create opportunities, you know, at literally every level of your career, no matter, you know, if you're just starting or if you're well on your way. It's as simple as this. It's basically always just give the people around you what they want, or better yet, if you can kind of figure it out, what they actually need. Just give people around you what you want or what they need.
Right. To empower them, basically, and then they can...
Well, you know. Yeah, it means... Look around you, you know, solve problems for the people around you. It doesn't matter if they're below you or above you or beside you. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter at all. Just become a problem solver, you know.
Yeah.
You get noticed for it, and people will always want more of it. And nothing really builds your value quicker, you know, or better than becoming known as the guy that solves problems. You know what I mean? Like, gets things done.
Right. Remove roadblocks, you know, so that people are like, wow.
And you have to, you have to step out of your comfort zone a little bit. Sometimes you have to really think and, you know, really look at situations and think them through and figure out what the roadblock actually is. Cause it's not always, a lot of times it's not obvious at all, you know, what the holdup is. But man, if you're willing to work a little extra to make the whole team look good, you know, not just yourself, but you do it, you know, you do it for the team. You'll get the credit you deserve, you know, either initially or eventually you'll get the credit for it, because you'll become known for that. You become known for working harder and smarter. And, you know, if you can do both and keep your eyes wide open while you do it, that's the advice that I like to give.
No, that's great advice. And don't just focus on yourself, focus on helping others, you know, removing those roadblocks and, you know, empowering people. And then they'll keep coming back to you, right? Like, you know, like, wow.
Absolutely.
Dwayne took care of that for me. I trust Dwayne. I'll give him something else.
Well, that I really lived that at Sony, because I started, you know, they brought me there to do mocap because that's what I knew and that's what I did. And that is what I knew. And I didn't know, you know, the other five or six disciplines that I ended up, you know, building into my group. I didn't know those things like a new mocap inside and out.
Right. But yeah, audio production, right? That wasn't your background, right? But you learned it.
But I saw what was going wrong with the audio group in terms of the way they were doing their services and the thing, you know, the things that were holding them back from being successful. By the time I did that, I had done a couple of things. And so my bosses above me kind of began to trust me and kind of, I think, look at me that way as a guy that could, you know, kind of figure things out. And so they gave me, you know, for a good stretch run there, we did some crazy growth. And it's all because I'd go to them and propose something. They'd say, yeah, sure, go do it.
Right.
And part of it was because we were, you know, a cash rich company at that time. And I think there were less, you know, for a little golden stretch there were, you know, it was good times for all. And I took full advantage of that. You know, I expanded like crazy, but every single thing I did became a beneficial thing to the effort, which was producing high quality games for PlayStation.
Right. And, you know, set up the departments and got the equipment and things like that. You didn't, you know, go crazy like Ion Storm and build out movie theaters and
exactly.
You know, ceiling clouds that would block the sun and do all this like crazy stuff they did. Just based on ego versus actually adding value back to the company.
Yeah, and I didn't ever pull anything out of my, you know, backside. I talked to people and I gained enough understanding of what we could and couldn't do and what was possible and what, you know, might be, you know, impossible or not worth, you know, doing. I kind of did my homework and did my legwork on, you know, any of those things before I started them. But Yeah. Got advice from people who knew. I mean, we were lucky in that we had a good contractual relationship with several people that would work on Hollywood, you know, CG animated films in Hollywood, for mostly mm-hmm. for the Sony, you know, the Sony groups up there. And then we would get them to come down and, you know, help us with our pipeline, you know, with our rendering pipeline or the, you know, the way we set up for our lighting, or, you know, the tools that we use, and the, you know, just everything that the tools that we needed to develop. And so we mm-hmm. got a lot of expertise that way. And in some ways I leveraged a lot of that expertise to build bigger and better things within our services group there.
Yeah. And yeah, smart, right? If you have those connections through the parent company, take advantage of them and reach out and be reciprocal and do those kind of things. That's great.
And the reason I like to add the disclaimer to it now is because, like I said, I got some people promoted into positions that they actually didn't want, because I just assumed that they would, and they were good. Mm-hmm. They were, you know, the people knew what they were doing. They were good people, but they weren't the proud type that wanted to be the head of, you know, the IT department or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
And so I learned that lesson that not everybody has those same type of, you know, wants and desires where their career is involved. And the one thing that kind of does happen when you do what I'm suggesting here is that you will tend to rock the boat a little bit. You know, you may get some pushback from your peers as they become your subordinates, you know, eventually. Or you may, what happens a lot of times is somebody that's your quote unquote superior may, you know, really take offense that you're coming up on the right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You have to be the personality type that's willing to, you know, push through all that and deal with it, because that will happen. You know, it's not always going to be just a gentle process. Sometimes you have to kind of battle a little bit, you know?
Right. Yeah. And to your other point too, that is a good point about, you know, sometimes promoting people that don't want to be promoted. And I've seen that a lot myself too, where there are people that are very good at a discipline, you know, whether it's an engineer or artist or whatever. And then they get in a management role, but they're not happy, right? They want to be individual contributors, and that's where they're happiest, you know, just sitting there writing code and not attending meetings and doing those kind of things. So you need to kind of get a read on that. And, you know, for companies, have tracks where you can still get promoted and increase your salary and things without feeling that the only path you have is management, because that sometimes forces people to want to go into management just because they want to make more money, but then they're not happy, you know, in that role, and they're more happy, you know, in front of the computer,
right,
doing their thing and not sitting in those meetings.
Yes, so, exactly. Yeah. You're exactly right. And the thing is, the good news is a lot of these companies have matured a ton, you know, by now.
Mm-hmm.
Like even Sony in those days, it was a little bit of Wild West, you know. And like I say, I didn't intentionally like take advantage of that, but I did use it to my advantage, because it was like, hey, what do we need? How do we do it? I don't know. You know, nobody knows. Okay, let me do it, you know. And I would go do it. And so a lot of things we learned by doing, you know. So it was kind of a bit open like that. But the flip side of that is what you're talking about, which is everything wasn't so established about, you know, what's the hierarchy tree, what's the career path, what's, you know, all those things had to mature as well, you know. Pretty much all elements of the business all matured over time. And they've gotten better, you know. They've gotten better.
Yeah, in certain companies, I think all companies at a certain size are smarter about that, and some are more progressive about it, you know.
Yeah.
All right, and I got a tough question for you here. Like, what's been your one or two favorite games or projects to work on, if you have to pick, say, one or two of them?
Well, I think you know what I'm going to say here, John. At least, probably, right?
Starts with an M?
Starts with an M, ends with a K.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mortal Kombat, baby. Well, I mean, the thing is, as a company, we sort of do specialize in high-end character stuff. And, you know, we're now deeply involved with the MK and Injustice franchises, you know, going back quite a few games now, and hopefully, you know, knock on wood, into the future as well. And those franchises, you know, with the legendary characters and the just, you know, honestly, absolutely kind of stunning level of rendering and lighting, you know, full screen effects in those games, the animation, just it all comes together, and it's a lot of fun and wackiness too, which, you know, for a character or a team that specializes in character production for, you know, works hard for a long, long time, it's really rewarding when those games come out. Cause, you know, we got 50 people in our studio in Argentina, and they just work on, you know, this stuff, you know, for months and years. And then when it comes out, we set up a big party and we have a tournament, and everybody tries to claim the crown, you know, and those guys will just, you know, they'll build their characters and get all the gear and do all the customizations and, you know, do the whole playthrough, the whole tree. And like a good majority of them will go all the way through the whole game. So it's fun to love what you, you know, helped produce.
Yeah. And to see, you know, the success it's having. I think I saw something today online about how MK is the number one selling game of 2019.
Yeah, and I think it deserves it too, because just look at it. I mean, it's amazing.
Oh yeah,
it really is.
It's 3 hours of cutscenes.
Yeah, and I love that. I mean, to me, that's my favorite part of the MK games, is that story stuff. You know, until maybe the Wonder Woman film, I think the DC Universe stuff, the Injustice franchise, those were the best DC character movies out there. Was the cutscenes in the Netherrealm Injustice games. I honestly, I really felt that way. Now they've made a couple of good ones. Aquaman, it wasn't my favorite because I thought it was a bit over the top, but a lot of people love Aquaman, and I have no problem with that. I can see why. But the Wonder Woman, movie, I thought that was pretty well done, pretty good. So they're getting it right a little bit, which is great, because those are iconic, world-class characters, and you want to see them served well like that. But up until recently, man, I tell you, the Netherrealm stuff was beating it all, We love the Capcom games. We did a ton of work for Monster Hunter World and Resident Evil and Street Fighter V, and those are all great too. And we did the Assassin's Creed games for Ubisoft. We're constantly working on that stuff for them. We've done a few in the Call of Duty franchise. And for me, I'm a big FPS guy, so that's my jam right there. Call of Duty stuff, and really, more so the Star Wars Battlefront is probably my main game now, because I just love Battlefront because it's Star Wars.
It's Star Wars, right?
They're a guy, but it's the graphics are just amazing on it. I mean, it looks real, and I can't imagine, how much better it's going to get, but I love playing through that. And I got to give DICE a huge amount of credit, because that game did not have a good start, through no fault of theirs, but they've done a fantastic job of bouncing back from that by releasing content, improving gameplay, and just all around supporting that game really pretty well. And I say that as a fan of the game, and someone who plays it, at least weekly, if not more.
Yeah, no, that's very cool. And I was talking about this on a different podcast. It's now, games are living, breathing things. They're live services. There's always going to be updates, and in olden times it would go on a disc, or even older, in a cartridge, and you dust your hands and that's what it is, right? But yeah, it's smart when companies follow the fan reaction, they make adjustments, they do, updates and improve and iterate and make the games better, versus just like, those people don't know what they're talking about, and ignoring the feedback.
Yeah, there's nothing worse you can do when you have a little bit of pushback than to just say that and carry on,
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why, in this world today, and as bad as that was when they launched that game, because of some of the decisions that were pushed down upon them, they've really done everything I think humanly possible as a developer to push through all that and really make a great game that people, many people really do enjoy and really, really love to play. And I give them all the credit in the world for that.
They're in Sweden, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, cool. Like, what are you curious about right now in the industry? There's all these different trends going on and things like.
Well, kind of we're touching on a little bit here, but like many, gamers out there, I like to think about what the future holds with the next gen of consoles. And we're starting to get a little bit of a look at that now. Some of the specs came out for the next Xbox, and that's interesting. I don't know what you can do with 8K versus 4K. we'll see, I guess. We'll
buy a new TV. Yeah.
But then, and then you think about what even comes after that. What the hell is that going to be like? It's crazy. But, like we were just talking about, if you look at the Mortal Kombat's and the Battlefronts of the world right now, and many other games on the PS4, the Xbox One system, the graphics are just completely believable and realistic. I mean, I play and watch people play those a lot, and they are just really, really good. So it's hard to imagine how much better it can get, but then again, it always does, does. So that kind of thing intrigues me a little bit right now. And you just touched on something, from a business perspective for us, that steady evolution of, up the graphical realism ladder that games, the consoles and therefore the games have been taking has been an absolute boon to our business, because with the data streaming and the constant uplighting, the updating of the games after they've launched, it kind of blows the roof off of, the amount of content a game can hold. And what we're seeing now is that we'll spend a solid year in production working on the content for the launch version of the game. And then we may spend another year and a half working on all the stuff that comes within the life cycle of it.
DLC and all that kind of stuff.
A long tail now. And man, that's really made what was kind of a tough business to be in so much better. you know, in terms of the cyclical nature of the way development worked, because we would be on a project and maybe work for 1 or 2 years in production. And then no matter how good that relationship is or how successful we were for our part of that project, that developer is going to ship that game and then go down. You know, they're not going to put their heads up again.
Right.
God, you know, sometimes they'll go through a whole green light process and a design process. It may be 2 years or three before they start production again. And so it almost didn't matter how well you did for a client. That client was still going to disappear on you and leave you with 50 guys that need to be working on something. You know, from our perspective.
Right, feast or famine type stuff,
So then what do you get? You're lucky, you work hard, you go out there and market the crap out of things, and you end up getting another big project. Well, then you got to do that whole ramp up. You got to learn all the people. Get their whole pipeline figured out.
Pipeline.
You got to figure out the art director.
Points of contact.
Little details that the art director loves and what they hate. You know, you got all that stuff. And then, you know, you're managing people and managing, you know, keeping them happy because they're working on stuff that they enjoy. But man, this whole long tail of, you know, that comes from the games as service model has really kind of made our life so much better, because now we can work long term on projects. And by the time we, you know, get to the end of that DLC tail, we're kind of, you know, that client's kind of ready to start the next project.
Right. Yeah. Going to production on the next thing. Yeah. So there's very little of a gap. Yeah.
And then it benefits them too, because then they don't lose us to whoever the other client is we have to go get, because now we're still there ready for their production. And we still have all that communication, all that relationship and all that knowledge and know-how of the specifics of how things get done on their project. It's all there. It's ready to go. It's ready to ramp right back up.
Yeah.
And so it's a big benefit to everyone. And for us, it really takes that, you know, that big hill and valley out of the equation.
Yeah. You're like an extension of the company, right?
Yep.
Yeah. It is beneficial because, yeah, I've been in situations where it's like, you want to keep working with a company like your company, but you can't because there is those gaps. And then you worry too, on the other side, like, you know, crap, when we need them again, are they going to be, you know, sorry, we're buried for 6 months with a new client. And then,
And we'd have no choice. We have to.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You've got payroll and you've got to run a business. Exactly. So yeah, makes sense. What about potential threats you see to the game industry and things like that? Like, wow, this is scary.
Well, there's this, from our perspective, you know, sitting in our little corner of the industry and what we kind of do and what we deal with as kind of our production, you know, specialist company, there's kind of a, you know what a MacGuffin is? The MacGuffin. It's in a film. It's kind of a plot. Well, maybe that's not the best. MacGuffin is a
red herring.
Yeah, it's a plot device that it provides a kind of a common thread for, you know, and maybe a motivating factor for characters and or to kind of tie things to, you know, disparate parts of the film together. But it doesn't have any meaning beyond that. Usually, it's like, you know, the famous example is the briefcase in Pulp Fiction. You know, it's kind of everybody's after the briefcase, but the briefcase really never was anything. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
but
it just glowed at one point. But yeah, there was, what's the point?
It kind of holds, it's a common thread kind of thing.
Okay.
But like I said, maybe that's not the best analogy. Maybe it's more like a boogeyman, you know, it's something that exists out there kind of beyond the horizon, but it's coming to get you eventually.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Okay.
So the thing that fits that for us is the, what I call the button. And you know what that is? That's like that technology that's ever approaching, that's almost here. It's a software tool or it's an online, you know, catalog, or it's whatever it is that allows you to just make all your game content without making all your game content. You know what I mean?
Right. Like, automate it.
The character generator or the, you know, the automated character production machine, or, you know, whatever that is. It's kind of like the speed tree of everything, you know, all the art content. But then if you look at speed tree, you know, that came along and that, what did that do? It's a tool that allows you to make a whole shit ton more very good trees and bushes and everything else, but you still have to, you know, you still have to have artists working on that stuff. You know, so ultimately it's a tool, and it allows you to do more and better, and it advances things a lot. But, you know, when things advance a lot, all that does is push the envelope further out. And then when you push the envelope further out, there's a gap there, and the gap gets filled with people, artists, programmers,
right.
You know, so that danger is not a real danger. But in the past, I've actually, you know, put time to really look, you know, thinking about that when we're doing our 5-year projections and where we think we're going to be, and, you know, what are the threats and that sort of thing. Because every so often, you know, like I remember Autodesk was working on an automated character generation thing. And I think that was their goal, was to try to make a, you know, game developers could just buy their tool and generate the hell out of characters and never have to do it again. And it just doesn't, cut it. It just, you know, there's various reasons why, but they just don't cut it. So for me, you know, from our perspective, looking at things, that would be one of the threats that I would kind of, you know, I've kind of had in the back of my mind in the past, but now that I'm talking about it, I really don't think it is a threat, to be honest.
Okay. So in terms of your company, you have people in Argentina, you're in the Arizona area. I forgot, was there a third location or how was that set up?
Well, we have three studios in China because we started originally in China.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah,
right.
Our initial investor that we agreed with and started our company under agreement with was based in a city called Ningbo, which is just south of Shanghai in China.
Okay.
And they got us our start, and we set up a unique business deal there. But ultimately, it comes down to, you know, they own property and they wanted to do something in digital production that dealt with clients worldwide. And we sort of fit that bill for them. And so they were able to provide us a really, really nice brand new building facility in a nice part of a nice city. And put up the, you know, the initial startup capital that we needed to get started. And we were able to provide them with a company that fit the bill for everything that they needed in order to get the benefits that they get from the government to own that building. One of those type of deals, you know?
Yeah.
So that initially I was going to China, you know, a lot the first year or two to kind of, you know, dog and pony show.
Build the team and
But I have a great partner there, Leon Wong. He's fantastic. And he and I built what is now three studios, one in Ningbo that we started with, a bigger one in Beijing, which is where Leon is from. That's our main studio, really, the Beijing studio. And then we have another one that's in Outer Mongolia, actually. It's centrally located between like three major universities. So it's kind of our feeder studio. So we get younger people coming right out of school, and we train them up in the way we do things. And then we're able to transplant them over to one of the other two studios when they're ready to, you know, go full time for us.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. So you tap into the universities and you build up the roster from there, and then you can move them around. Cool. All right. So you do a lot of console stuff, obviously. What about thoughts on AR and VR? You have any thoughts on that personally or professionally?
Oh, yeah. What do you think? Yeah, definitely. We have done quite a bit of work on both VR and AR products through our studios, and mainly in China. Well, the Argentine studio is basically, it's just supporting one client all the time. So that's a great, great thing to be in. But that studio has grown and it's doing very, very well. But it's dedicated, basically. It's a dedicated model. So and everything else we do is through one of our three China studios. Most of it flows through Beijing and then gets kind of doled out by the other two in support. But we have done quite a bit of VR and AR stuff. In fact, we even developed our own AR product, an app for the China mobile market.
Okay.
It was a pretty cool little thing. But, you know, I didn't want to stray too far from our core business model, because I believe if you divert your attention away from what you're really there to do, then you're setting yourself up for risk. And so I'm the one that kind of put the cap on our venture into, you know, becoming a developer in that way. But we have done a lot of the VR and AR stuff. And actually, I have a couple of VR systems here in the house at home for the kids. That we have the PlayStation VR, and then we have the Oculus system. What I think about those from a user perspective, from a consumer perspective, I think they're great. They're a lot of fun. And I think they have a lot of potential. From my personal experience, I think even, you know, the console-based VR, you have to kind of get it out and hook it up and have wires going across the room.
Yeah.
The way your PlayStation is connected to your TV. And there's a whole setup process. And then there's you can't store it neatly, because you can't just kind of shove it over by the TV, or it's going to be laying there getting stepped on and not looking so great. Like the PS4 looks great just sitting by the TV. You know, it looks like a piece of equipment. You know, it's nice.
Right.
But when you have all the VR accoutrements laying around, it kind of looks like a mess.
Yeah, cables.
For that simple reason, I think that's a big part of the reason we don't use it all that often, because it is fun. Mm-hmm. It's a fun, you know, it's a fun family thing to do. It's fun to do it by yourself sometimes.
Yeah.
Until that gets, until the technology advances to the point where I think, you know, you have like some form of Google glasses that can transition to full VR mode, something like that. Mm. If it becomes ubiquitous, then I think it'll really, really take off. But, that'll come down the pike, probably not too far from now. But until then, I think it's a little bit hampered just strictly by a convenience issue. And professionally speaking, there's a limitation to it, because it basically, the assets that you can produce for that, it basically equate to about half, like 50% of what you can do.
Right, because the frame rate has to be 60 for both.
Well, and you have to render everything in stereo.
Yeah, exactly.
So basically your budget for, you know, your poly count, and I think it even affects texture use, but it basically knocks everything down to half, which it almost puts you at, you know, last gen visual quality. You can do some tricks and get some of it looking pretty good, but it does, you know, it takes you back a little bit.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I've talked about a lot in the show, and I had a chance to check it out yet. And I know it's not as powerful as some of the other systems, but like the Oculus Quest, you know, just not having the cables and not having the setup and not having to have the expensive PC, and you can just kind of, you know, plug it, put it on the head and fire it up, and a much easier point of entry to get in there and play without those friction points of digging out things and plugging things in and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, curious to see where that thing, that platform goes.
Well, say even that, it's already getting there. You know, it's moving in that direction.
Yeah.
I think that's what it needs. That's where it needs to go to really kind of realize its full potential to me.
Right. Yeah. To get out of to go beyond just hobbyists and people that have the patience and the time and the space to deal with all that, to actually be something that is easier to use. And what's a game that you're playing right now that you're excited about?
Well, I'm on my second playthrough of Red Dead Redemption 2. Red Dead Redemption.
Wow, second.
And Red Dead Redemption 2 are probably my all-time favorite games. And my son as well. I have a 16-year-old. And I think he's mm-hmm. on his third playthrough. He played once as a nice person and once as an evil bad guy. And now he's going for 100% completion, which, if you've ever looked into that game, 100% completion is a high bar. But he's going for it. He's almost got it. I think there are a couple things in there that are literally impossible to do. But he's been working at it. And
how many hundreds of hours is he in?
I don't know. I don't even want to know.
Yeah.
But he is really, really good at it. I can tell you that. Both Battlefront and Red Dead, you play online and you just never want to see this guy coming because he's just the headshot master and he's always at the top of the board, you know. And sometimes he'll have like 98 kills and the next guy has 45, you know. It's not unusual. Right. Yeah. He's probably not the best in the world, but he's in the top, you know, probably 5% I would give him.
Yeah, that's impressive.
But yeah, we love those games. And of course, MK11, I'm playing, you know, going through that. And we pull that up all the time. The kids were playing it just this afternoon here a little bit before we got through.
Yeah, new characters coming out too, right? Yep. So they always new keeps it fresh. Yeah.
And cool new characters too. They really don't skimp on them. They're something to kind of get excited about when they come out. They're really, you know, interesting characters.
Yeah. And I see Ed posting on Twitter and, you know, like, oh, wow, the character's coming out now and stuff like that. So it's got to be.
Yeah, that's a big part of our role is we know what those characters are going to be, you know, sometimes a year in advance or more. And we have to keep, you know, everybody has to keep the lid on that. But
oh, yeah, for sure.
It's pretty fun to see them coming out when we finished working on them like six months ago. Yeah. Some cases.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they've been in the can for a while, and now they're like, okay.
Yep.
Now the world gets to see them, and everyone gets to get excited about them. And
it is fun to follow those forums and see people getting excited about that stuff. And Ed and company, you know, they do a great job of promoting that stuff and getting everybody hyped up for it. They do a fantastic job with that stuff.
Yeah.
Because they care, you know, they really do care about it. That's what's so great about that
passion.
Yeah.
Yep, for sure. Is there anything I should have asked you about but didn't?
You know, if you get me talking, I can go on forever, but so you're probably lucky that you didn't ask me about any other any additional, you know, topics beyond what we covered. But no, I think you did a nice job, and as you always do, and we covered a good bit.
Thank you. Great. So where can people find you online and, you know, website, Twitter, things like that?
Well, the company website's at nxastudios.com, and we do have an online portfolio there and several other pages that kind of feature what we do as a company and the type of work that we do.
Mm-hmm.
I do have an Instagram, but to be honest, it's all about, you know, mostly my kids and my cars. And, you know, I'm older, so I never really got into setting up a Twitter for the company. I just didn't want to maintain that every day. And nobody really wants to see a tweet of every trade show we attend or the characters that we built a year ago. So
that's fine.
We really don't have a lot more beyond the website.
Yeah. It's great that people can go there, check it out, see the portfolio, see all the great work that your teams do. And, you know, learn more about the studio, nxastudios.com. That's great.
Thank you.
Well, cool. Well, thanks, Dwayne. It's been great having you on the show. And yeah, I appreciate you talking about your background and let people know the roots of mocap and all these kind of cool things that you worked on and be involved with LucasArts and Sony and all these excellent projects.
Yeah, it's been a really fun ride. And I wholeheartedly recommend to anyone who's interested in getting into game development to go for it, because it's only going to get bigger. It's getting bigger and better all the time. Like we touched on earlier, the working conditions are really fair and good. You know, there's very few instances of the tough stuff that used to happen a lot. It's a very mature industry these days. There's a lot of great companies, and there's always innovation, and there always will be.
Yeah, cool. Thanks. Okay, cool.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it. It's a good time.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast. If you found it interesting or helpful, please leave a 5-star review. I'd really appreciate it. And don't forget to subscribe. I have a lot of great episodes coming out. As always, I want to hear from you, the game development community. So give me a call at 224-484-7733 or reach out on the website, gamedevadvice.com. I want to know your struggles, your questions, and your ideas. Since the podcast is really about you, the fellow game developer, and our game development community. Thanks and take care.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.